turn on the Drake off horsesea receiver with its noise blanker, and you heard just a little bit of squittery noise, I could aim my antenna directly at Montauk Point. A weak guy on 432 in New Jersey coming into the back lobe of my antenna, which is to the west, when my antenna is aimed to the east, I could easily hear him and demodulate him. So that radar blanker, the noise blanker, was handling pulses well above 100 dB above my threshold. Man, is that a noise blanker. And I studied that to figure out how it does it. And it was a relatively broadband circuit on the very first stage, which looks for the very steep rise time. The leading edge of the radar pulse gives you a very steep rise time. So there was a kind of a differentiator circuit that would fire a monostable. The monostable fired some field effect transistors that became an extremely high open circuit. More than 100 dB of shielding was the circuit. The circuit would open the path. Let me drop it. The circuit would open the path between the mixer and the first IF stage. See, the problem with impulse noise, radar pulse noise, is that the noise pulse from the radar is so extremely strong that when it hits the tuned circuits of your first IF stage and your second IF stage, it sets them ringing like a bell. So the noise blanker, a really effective noise blanker, has to be in front of all of the significant tuned stages. The output of the mixer was at least 10 megacycles broad. There's a little bit of tuning there, but not much. I think the first IF on that receiver, I believe, is 10.7 megacycles. And before your IF strip gets ringing, that thing has to do its job. It creates a perfect open circuit during the radar pulse. However, when you use that noise blanker with 60 cycle noise coming from a pulse rate transformer, it gave you an improvement, but nowhere near as significant an improvement. So the most severe pulses are radar pulses. The good news is the radar pulse has got an extremely steep rise time. The differentiator that fires the noise blanker can easily see that steep rise time and do its thing. So the nature of the noise that you're trying to blank makes a huge difference. There are certain kinds of noise where that style of noise blanker might not be very effective. And let me drop. And those kind of noise blankers, those kind of noises from that radar in that IF strip will almost not show up on a spectrum analyzer. An extremely fast, high-frequency oscilloscope with a very low capacitance loading probe. So it's a high impedance probe on a high gain, very fast oscilloscope will be able to see those pulses. And so the total amount of energy of those pulses, you know, and total number of milliwatts is not very large. Therefore, it's not going to show up unless you have extremely unusual ways of tuning your spectrum analyzer. You're not going to see it. But a very fast oscilloscope could see it. So you're going to have to see the nature of the pulses that you're trying to blank. I think you're going to have to see them on a real good oscilloscope, Joe. You're not going to see it on a spectrum analyzer, with rare exceptions. And whether or not you're getting the proper performance out of your noise blanker is highly dependent on what does the leading edge of each noise impulse look like. I know this is not exactly the answer you're looking for, but hopefully it's some of the information that will help a little bit, Joe. W-H-O-L-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, so I did this same test of one of my other radios a couple of months ago. I come up with 10 meters. I had a differential of about 23, 24, maybe 25 dB between the received sensitivity and looking at into the antenna on 10 meters. So noise was obviously higher. Here's a question related to that, for looking at both bands. The noise energy that you're seeing that is degrading your receiver and preventing you from hearing something below a certain level, how fast is that noise going across the frequency? It's got to be much faster than 100 kilohertz, because apparently the noise blanker in my FM, in this particular FM receiver, is not capable of catching something that high and that brief in time duration to do anything with it to make it effective at all.
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying here, Joe. when you study a branch of mathematics called the Fourier series, Fourier transform, but let's call it Fourier series, and if you've got something that's giving you repetitive pulses, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air just to make the mathematics turn out convenient. If I'm looking at a radar, where each pulse out of the radar is 1 microsecond long, and the rep rate of that radar is 1,000 pulses per second. 1 kilohertz is the rep rate. And assume that that radar is set at exactly 400 megacycles, and I tune my spectrum analyzer to 400 megacycles, what are you going to see? Depending on how you set the controls of the spectrum analyzer, the resolution bandwidth makes a huge difference. But in general, you're going to see a whole lot of energy at 400 megacycles, the main center frequency of the carrier. Let me drop this. When you set the resolution bandwidth to a small enough number, like 100 hertz, because the rep rate of the radar is 1 kilohertz, when you study the mathematics of Fourier series, what's really coming out of that radar is a zillion individual sine wave lines that'll show up on the spectrum analyzer screen, where each individual line is 1 kilohertz separated from the adjacent line. That's what the rep rate is doing. The 1,000 pulses per second are making a line every 1 kilohertz in spacing. And because the pulse duration of each pulse is 1 microsecond, you're going to see these lobes, these sine x over x lobes, where each individual lobe is around 1 megacycle wide. So 1 megacycle wide, 1 kilohertz of spacing of individual lines inside of that envelope means you've got, if I got the numbers right, there's 1,000 lines inside of each envelope. So you're going to see a whole bunch of these sine x over x envelopes with a whole bunch of lines in between. Well, very rarely when you're looking at a radar, are you going to be using a filter as fine as 100 kilohertz. A correction, now 100 hertz. In order to separate the individual lines that are 1 kc1. The average person in that case is going to set the spectrum analyzer for a resolution bandwidth of something like 100 kilohertz, because the main beam of the radar does a sweep around the horizon once every 12 seconds or so. It's only aimed at you for a few milliseconds. Therefore, you have to have the spectrum analyzer set in such a way that it can sweep rapidly so it can catch the signal you're trying to look at. Let me drop. And the spectrum analyzer can only be sweeping rapidly if you have something like a 30 kilohertz or a 100 kilohertz resolution bandwidth, if not even more. So when the resolution bandwidth is set that wide, it can no longer resolve the individual spectral lines. It now starts grouping them together. You'll still see the envelope, the sine x over x envelope, but the amplitude you see on the screen is wrong because it's not looking at one line at a time. It's looking at, if using the 100 kc bandwidth, it's looking at 100 individual spectral lines at once, at each instant of time, and it mixes them together in some crazy way as it sweeps across the screen. So, spectrum analyzer looking at impulse noise is a very difficult thing to do. And one other thing I should mention, because that radar, with its 1 microsecond pulse duration of each individual radar pulse, and 1,000 of those pulses per second, in my example, if it's a well-designed radar, the rise time of each individual pulse is around a nanosecond, and the fall time is around a nanosecond. So the rise time is a nanosecond, pulse duration is a microsecond, then a nanosecond of fall time, then roughly a millisecond of time before the next pulse comes along. That's what I just described to you. Now, because the rise time is around a nanosecond, a significant amount of energy out of that radar is spread across 1 gigahertz of spectrum, 1,000 megahertz. Where did that come from? Let me drop. 1 nanosecond rise time. The rise time of the pulse tells you something about how far the energy is going to be smeared. You're going to see sine x over x lobes that are going to go out pretty close to 500 megacycles above the center frequency and 500 megacycles below. So, as you can tell, radars are a very nasty signal to try to handle in a receiver that's being jammed, that's trying to listen to sideband FM or whatever. This is some of the information you're looking for. This is some of what a noise blanker is fighting, because that's the worst kind of noise. The impulse noise you get out of an ignition system from an automobile or a lawnmower comes close. It also has a rise time that's a fairly small number of nanoseconds. Therefore, it's a very broadband signal at the rip rate that your lawnmower is turning its crankshaft, if you know what I mean. So, lawnmower ignition noise or automobile ignition noise, a good noise blanker can handle that very well, can handle a radar very well, but the kind of noise you get out of a 60-cycle pole pig transformer, not so well. Let me drop. And if somebody in your neighborhood, Joe, has a fish tank heater, which has a set of contacts that are trying to control the temperature, and they're going on and off and arcing and sparking, a noise blanker is going to give you an improvement, but nowhere near the kind of improvement I'm discussing, because that's a kind of signal that doesn't have a clearly defined rip rate, a clearly defined rise time, that's easy for the differentiator circuit that fires the blanker for it to detect the leading edge of the noise that it has to blank. On top of that, the arcing and sparking no longer is only a microsecond long and you blank for that long. The arcing and sparking might last for milliseconds, and the noise blanker tends not to blank for that period of time. If it did, very little signal would be flowing through your receiver, if you know what I mean. So this is some of what you're fighting, Joe. During the days when British television on Channel 1, 4 or 5 lines of television in the old days, used to be amplitude modulating for the audio, they had developed some very good noise blankers, but even then, they had problems of how do you properly set the automatic gain control of the receiver so that you still have the right threshold for, let me drop this. You still have the right threshold for the noise blanker, as well as controlling the automatic gain for the receiver to properly demodulate the signal you want to listen to. So there's a conflict of interest going on here between automatic gain control setting and whether or not the AGC circuit is a key AGC circuit. Does it really see the very brief impulse noises like ignition noise and radar pulse noises? Is the AGC being properly affected by those by comparison to the way it responds to, let's say, a steady FM carrier, which is a very different kind of AGC response? These are some of the variables you're dealing with, Joe, and it's not an easy one. The B2LYY, K2LYW in the tech net.
Okay, so how fast would you say the noise input, well, it's like a noise energy, looking across a particular bandwidth? Say, like, these radios are 5 kilohertz deviation, so what do you talk about? 9, 10, 11, 12 kilohertz of bandwidth, give or take? Probably not too much more than that. What is the repetition rate of the noise, or is there anywhere, I guess there's no way to really modify this noise blank to be able to look at that or cut through it to be able to make it work actually faster so you would lower the effective noise level of what what this noise energy is seeking? Because as I said, the noise energy coming in from the antenna, what you call just background noise from whatever source it's coming from, was about 10, 11, 12 dB higher, and it stayed at a steady level. It didn't change. There was no change noted. It stayed very, very constant, the constant level. And, you know, and it could always go there. Even going down to some lower frequencies, like some of the fire frequencies, the background noise really didn't change appreciably as far as relative level was concerned. So it was spread out over, you know, quite a bit of the low band frequencies. And it didn't sound, it didn't sound like you put a signal in here. It didn't sound like I was listening to 60-cycle energy being distributed across the entire band. This just sounds like open noise. You really can't hear it or define what you're listening to.
There have been very high-class noise blanking circuits, which have at least 2 or 3 additional knobs on the front panel. One knob is a manual override on the automatic gain control of the total receiver. That's knob number 1. Knob number 2 is the automatic gain control for the differentiator circuit that fires the noise blanker. Knob number three is the monostable duration time that each time the noise blanker is fired, how long does it fire for? Does it fire for 1 microsecond, 10 microseconds, 1 millisecond, and so on? In theory, if you have the world's best noise blanker and a very skilled operator, and he adjusts all those three knobs just right, he can get the best performance out of the noise blanker. However, the average guy who buys a communications receiver doesn't have the skill, the training, the knowledge to how to properly set those knobs. The manufacturer of the receiver, let me drop the... The manufacturer of the receiver did what he believed is the best he can do for making the automatic gain has some kind of sensitivity and remote cutoff characteristic to it for the main AGC of the receiver. The circuit that adjusts the automatic gain control for the differentiator for the noise blanker, he comes up with some number for that he thinks is going to work most of the time. And when it comes to the monostable pulse duration time for the noise blanker, he comes up with some number like 10 microseconds, and he hopes that that's going to work most of the time. But because he has taken those knobs off the front panel, because the average receiver user doesn't know how to properly use them, and if the average receiver user set those knobs in the wrong way, the receiver will turn dead all the time, and the person will be sending the receiver back to the factory. For a whole bunch of reasons, they usually don't give you those knobs. However, there are smart guys in certain difficult environments where they dug into their receiver and added those extra knobs, usually coming out the back panel. Sometimes they forced them to be on the front panel. But they built a separate box, a mini box, which had these extra knobs so that they could tune their particular noise blanker for their particular environment. As you can see, Joe, there's a real art and science to doing the right kind of noise blanking with enough performance to work most of the time. You don't have those knobs, but the best you can do is with your oscilloscope, a real fast oscilloscope with a very lightly loaded oscilloscope probe, touching various places in your noise blanker circuit. You'll eventually find out what's the nature of the noise that you're blanking and how is your noise blanker responding to it. It's going to take an oscilloscope. Majority of what you want to look at, you're not going to find it on a spectrum analyzer. The B2LYY.
Repeater, timeout.
All right, W, you got it, Joe. Wait for the beep.
Okay, Dick. In the original test setup for this receiver, maintenance in a commercial Motorola, two-way radio, they give you a simple procedure without a noise pulse generator to test the blanker circuit just to see if it does anything at all. And what they tell you to do is ground one test point inside the radio and look at another point, which is the that input transistor. It's actually a pair of that blank the IF. They tell you to look at the gate of that FET with a scope on a 10-to-1 setting. And they tell you to feed it 100% modulated AM at 10 kilohertz, which I did, and I can see the impulses at 10 kilohertz. That means the beginning of each pulse is 100 microseconds from the beginning. They give me one pulse to the beginning of the next pulse. The pulse width looked like it was about 20 microseconds or so, give or take. Now, I purposely ran the modulation backwards. I ran it down to 5 kc. 2,500 cycles, 1,000, 500, 350, and I saw the pulses just simply get wider and wider. So it proved to me that the noise blanker circuit was able to hear lower frequency noise impulses and do something with them as far as blanking purpose. But I ran the modulation capability of the circuit monitor really does not want to modulate AM very much above 10 kilohertz, so I really couldn't test it higher than that. Back to you.
Yeah, most noise blankers, when you start making the pulse rip rate very low and the rise time of the pulse is very long, is not going to work correctly because the majority of the noise it's trying to blank is impulse noise. That's the most wicked kind of noise that sets your IF strip ringing, that makes listening to audio or Morse code very, very difficult. But as I said before, there is no ideal noise blanker. There's something called a LAMB, L-A-M-B noise blanker, which is used on a certain kind of radar jamming, which works by a very different principle, which I'm not going to go into tonight. So the cheapest and dirtiest noise blankers that were on some receivers, you flip the switch on the front panel called noise blanker, and all you're getting is a pair of back-to-back diodes on the audio output transformer, which takes the spike that wants to go to the loudspeaker and lowers those spikes. Well, that's way too far downrange. That's very ineffective as a noise blanker. And your IF strip has already been, all your stages of your IF strip are ringing with the impulse noises that are coming into the antenna. So that's the cheapest and dirtiest noise blanker, just simple back-to-back diodes on the audio output. Does a lot. That does a really lousy job. But the kind of noise blanker that's on the very first stage in front of the first IF amplifier stage, first IF filter, which has got a very high on-off ratio, like 100 dB, hopefully, of on-off ratio, with the right kind of a intelligent circuit that tells it when to fire, how often to fire, and for how long to fire. There's a real art and science to designing noise blankers for particular environments. So, you're in the learning stage. I was in the learning stage when I found out how effective that noise blanker was on this really horrendous radar that was bombing the daylights out of us in the early 1970s, that Montauk Point radar. That thing was putting out peak envelope powers well above, let me think now, I think it was in the terawatts. Yes, the peak envelope power out of that radar was multiple terawatts. That thing would burn a hole in the sky, if you know what I mean. And I'm almost within line of sight of that damn radar. And boy, did that bomb the daylights out of me. And this one receiver could handle that. And when I found out that receiver could do it, I started taking that circuit apart to try to figure out how in the world did it do that magic. Good luck with that research, Joe. As I said, there's a big learning curve on that one. I'm going to move on to the next person, which was Sam. AC2, SAM. Go right ahead with your question, Sam. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yes.
Thank you, Dick. This is KC1, SAM. Question has to do with priority and gain on an antenna. Let me just make sure I'm not doubling. Okay, a couple of weeks ago you had mentioned a Yagi that you tilted at 45 degrees, which gives you both vertical and polarity, and the horizontal polarity in the going into a signal, so maybe a 3 dB loss each way. My question has to do with, and let me drop. You take the driven element in a Yagi and replace it with a dipole, exactly aiming for at an angle of 45 degrees. In the forward direction, you obviously have the exact same situation with vertical and horizontal polarity. Let me break. Now I'm coming in on the 375 repeat. I only hear one beep. In that condition, not use from that. In other words, in the direction that the dipole would be leaning. Is that, I would assume it's vertical, but what do you have as far as gain or loss and so forth? Did I make that question clear? Back to you.
KC1, SAM, K2IW. I'm pretty sure I know what you're asking, Sam. A well-designed, well-tuned, well-constructed Yagi, well-constructed dipole, even a well-constructed corner reflector, and maybe even the right kind of a horn in front of a parabolic dish antenna. Most antennas on VHF have a fairly clearly defined linear polarization. If you could see that wave coming out of that antenna, when the antenna, when all the elements of the Yagi are parallel to the ground. That's a purely horizontally polarized Yagi antenna. All the signals it transmits, all the signals it receives, are horizontally polarized. The E field is parallel to the ground. The H field, the magnetic field, is perpendicular to the ground. We usually don't talk about the magnetic field. When we describe polarization of an antenna, we're talking about the E field. If you take that Yagi and loosen up the two bolts that are holding it to the mounting plate, so that you're able to rotate the boom of the Yagi. You're not changing where the Yagi is aimed. Let's assume that the Yagi is aimed dead north and it's aimed at a signal on the horizon. You're going to keep the angle, you're going to keep the Yagi aimed dead north, you're going to keep it aimed on the horizon, but you're going to stand behind the Yagi, grab the boom, and rotate the boom clockwise or counterclockwise. That's what you're doing when you're rotating the Yagi in polarization only. And if you rotated it 90 degrees, all of the elements of the Yagi would now be perpendicular to the ground, and the Yagi would be purely vertically polarized. Let me drop. So the nice thing about dipoles and Yagi-like antennas is that your human eye, with a little bit of intelligence, tells you exactly what polarization it has been set for when that antenna was mounted on the mast and put on top of the tower, or put on top of your chimney, if you know what I mean. If you make the antenna purely horizontally polarized, and now you ask the question, how well will it respond to a vertically polarized signal? That's a slightly ambiguous question. In theory, mathematically, it would be a very large number of dB suppressed. Could be 40 decibels suppressed. If the Yagi was absolutely, purely horizontally polarized. If you tilted it a couple of degrees from being parallel to the ground to a purely vertically polarized signal, the 40 dB of suppression would jump down to 25 dB of suppression. You'd get a 15 dB increase. That null that you get with cross polarization is an extremely sharp null. However, if the Yagi driven element is fed with, say, for instance, a gamma match rod or a T match rod, the structure of the driven element has a little bit of metal that is vertically polarized, therefore the Yagi will have a slight amount of vertical polarization response, even though it is set up for purely horizontal polarization. Let me drop. So therefore, even though mathematically a cross-polarized Yagi would give you 40 dB or so of signal rejection, you never see that much. But now let's get to the real world. With my 2-meter Yagi on my tower, I know that most of the time I talk to single sideband people that are purely horizontally polarized. I know that when I talk to the FM people, almost all the FM repeaters and the whip antennas on people's automobiles are purely vertically polarized. And in either case, I don't want to suffer the nearly 40 decibels of suppression if I've got the wrong polarization. So if I twist the boom of the Yagi so that now all the elements are set 45 degrees with reference to the ground, not quite parallel to the ground, so to speak, the boom is still aimed dead north, the boom is aimed at the horizon, but I have rotated the boom of the Yagi so that all the elements are tilted at a 45 degree angle. Your next question is going to be, as I rotate the polarization of the antenna compared to the signal I'm listening to, I know I'm going to get some suppression of the signal. How fast is that suppression? And the answer is cosine of the angle. If cosine of 0 degrees is unity, in other words, if the number of degrees of difference between the polarization of my antenna and the polarization of the signal I want to listen to is 0 degrees, cosine of 0 is 1, log of 1 is 0, I get 0 dB of suppression. I get no suppression when I'm co-polarized. Let me drop. If I tilted the Yagi 60 degrees compared to the signal I'm listening to, cosine of 60 degrees is 0.5. At 60 degrees, I'm going to get half the voltage in response out of the antenna. If my Yagi is tilted 60 degrees compared to the polarization of the signal I'm listening to, I'm going to get half the voltage. Power is E squared over R. Half voltage is 1/4 of the power. 1/4 of the power is 6 dB down. So at 60 degrees of rotation, I'm getting 6 decibels of suppression of the signal I want to listen to. You can see that when I set the antenna at 45 degrees, I'm halfway between horizontal, halfway between that and vertical. That is a cosine of 45 degrees is 1 over the square root of 2. That happens to be 3 dB of suppression. So I get 3 decibels of suppression of a vertical signal or a horizontal signal when my antenna is set at a 45 degree polarization. To me, 3 dB of suppression as opposed to 40 dB of suppression is a very good compromise. So my antenna is set that way. I can therefore talk to the horizontal people and the vertical people, and I know I'm 3 dB from IDO when I do it. I make up the difference by using more than one Yagi at a time, by stacking them. So I wonder if that's some of the information you're looking for, Sam. KC1, SAM. Wait for the beeps, KQIW in the TechNet.
KC1, SAM, picking up. Here's my exact question. You almost on it. Let's say it's aiming due north. 90 degrees to its right is east. Let's say you replace that Yagi with a dipole in the exact same location, and it's also angled at the exact same angle, 45 degrees off center. What does anyone to the east receive, since it's 90 degrees off of the north?
Okay, and if you did that with the Yagi, in most cases when you look at a Yagi off the side, 90 degrees away from the bore site, you get a very deep null. When it's co-polarized, when it's 45 degree polarized, life gets more complicated. I'm glad you asked for a dipole and not for a Yagi. If I'm using a dipole that's slanted at a 45 degree angle in polarization, the dipole responds to a broadside signal, and so I'm listening to a signal coming from the north. My dipole is set east-west, so it's getting the most amount of signal from it, and the eastern end of my dipole is raised above the ground, the western end of my dipole is suppressed lower down, so that the whole dipole is tilted at a 45 degree angle with reference to the ground. It's 45 degrees polarized. I'm going to see a 3 dB suppression of the signal I want to listen to coming from the north. When I look at that dipole from the east with a kind of receiver that can measure polarimetry, what am I going to see? I'm going to see a signal that is purely vertically polarized. When you take a dipole that's east-west, but it's tilted in polarization the way we're describing, eastern end is high, western end is low, and now you stand off to the east at a long distance and you look at it, you will see the closest part of the dipole is above the horizon, so to speak. The furthest end of the dipole is below the horizon. You will see a purely vertically polarized signal. Your next question is, how strong is that signal going to be? And I think the answer is 3 dB suppressed compared to what it would be if the dipole was purely vertical. Let me drop it. If the dipole was purely vertical, and I'm off to the east, and my antenna is doing the receive that is vertically polarized, I would see a full signal strength. But now with the dipole tilted in polarization 45 degree angle, favoring the north, and I'm at the east, I'm going to see a vertically polarized signal, 3 dB suppressed. If I'm using a horizontally polarized signal, and I'm looking from the east, in theory, I see nothing. When you're taking a photograph of that dipole, and you're standing off at a long distance to the east, and you're using your binoculars or your telescope, what do you see? You see some vertical extent of metal. You see no horizontal extent of metal other than the thickness. If it's a dipole made out of 14 gauge wire, you see an eighth of an inch of thickness or 16th of an inch of thickness, but it has no real horizontal extent of that in metal. It's got some vertical extent, it's got vertical polarization, but it has no ability to transmit a horizontally polarized signal to the east. So tilting the dipole does allow you to radiate the signal in all directions. Ordinarily, a purely horizontally polarized dipole. Let me drop this. Ordinarily, a purely horizontally polarized dipole would have a very deep null to the east when it's favoring north-south signals. East-west dipole, favoring north-south signals, is going to have a very deep null dead east and dead west. Tilt the dipole in polarization, you're now radiating a signal 3 dB down to the east and to the west, but the signal in that direction is purely vertically polarized from that point of view. Your next question is going to be, if I'm now looking at your dipole, not east, not north, I'm looking from the northeast, what am I going to see? Now you're looking at a very complicated three-dimensional situation. A dipole has got some horizontal, it's got some vertical. I think the answer is you're going to see elliptical polarization. But the nice thing about a slanted dipole is it's radiating some amount of RF signal in all compass directions around the compass, Sam. You're radiating some amount of signal in all directions. Your next question is going to be, would I really see no signal from the east with a purely horizontally polarized antenna? And the answer is, you would see some signal. Let me drop it. The signal being radiated to the east from the antenna itself, the tilted dipole, the signal radiated to the east is purely vertically polarized. But by the time that signal bounces off all those trees, buildings, water towers, and everything else to get to your house 10 miles away, there's going to be some other polarization there. As long as your receiver is sensitive enough, as long as the transmit power is high enough, you're always going to hear some signal, even though you think you're cross-polarized. To try to carefully tune an antenna in polarization to null a signal, in the real world, you'd be amazed how difficult that is to do. This particular repeater you're listening to right now in Glen Oak, and that's the 146.85, the 975-375 portion of this repeater out in Selden, both of those are purely vertically polarized antennas. No matter which one I listen to, I can only know about this one. The 146.85, when I listen to that one with my handy talkie sitting on the wooden shelf in my bathroom, I get the strongest signal when the handy talkie is laying on its side. By the time that signal bounces off all the stuff in my environment, including my tower, and it gets into my bathroom, that vertically polarized transmitted signal is horizontally polarized in my bathroom. Over to you, Sam. KC1, SAM. Polarization is strange stuff. K2LIW in the TechNet.
WHY, what a question on this subject.
Yeah, we're going to go to Sam first. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, Roger, let me pick it up there. Yeah, you did answer my question. If it was the original north and south, and we switched to a dipole, what do you see east and west? You did answer that question. See, the question that pops up is, where does that 3 extra dBs go, since you can't lose any energy? What direction does that extra 3 dB go into? If we lose 3 dB going north and south, and we lose 3 dB going east and west, where's the 3 decibels go to? Anyway, I'll swing it back to you. Dick, did you answer my... Let me just break for a second. And I'm using the 375 repeater in Selden. I'm up here in Connecticut. It does boom in. I appreciate it very much, but if you want to say a couple of words on that lost 3 dB, and I'm not worried about polarity too much. I'm a guy who has his antennas hoisted up in trees up here. I have a big canopy around my house. I live in the woods, basically. And I've got them hoisted up 85 feet, and it works pretty good. Altitude is a wonderful thing. Anyway, K2RIW, this is KC1SAM. I greatly appreciate your answer, Dick, and I'm going to bring it back to you, and you can give it to the other fellow asking questions.
Okay, if I was now doing a really pure antenna experiment, I'm an astronaut that's normally on the space shuttle. And to do this experiment, I put on my spacesuit, I've spaced myself away from the space shuttle. I'm out there with my handheld rocket, so to speak. So I'm 100 yards away from the space shuttle, and I've got this dipole really in free space. The ground is 160 miles below me, so there's no local ground, there's no local trees, there's no nothing. I got this dipole in free space. And by some magic, I'm able to see the signal coming out of that dipole. And I'm going to plot the signal in the normal way we plot antenna patterns. What would the pattern of that dipole be? It's a very big, fat donut. Is it like a bagel? Yeah, it's like a bagel, but let's call it a fat donut. If I took a fat donut and I put the wire of my dipole down the center of the hole of the donut, that's where that donut is furthest away from the wire. That's where the signal is strongest. So you can see that it's radiating a signal in all directions away from the dipole, broadside to the dipole. That's where the dipole, that's where the donut is thick. And off to the ends of the dipole, in that direction, you're radiating very little signal. So the dipole itself is always radiating that donut pattern. Now when you tilt the dipole at a 45 degree angle, the pattern out of the dipole itself does not change. You just take that donut pattern, which in the case of a horizontally polarized dipole, the donut itself, the major dimension of the donut is perpendicular to the ground. And in my example, the major portion of the donut is also aimed at the at north, if you know what I mean.
Repeater, timeout.
So that donut pattern stays there, except that now when you tilt the wire, you're tilting the donut pattern. You're not changing where the signal goes as far as the dipole is concerned. But now how it affects the environment and how it bounces off the ground, yeah, that makes a great big difference. So the dipole always radiates that pattern. The B2LYY with an additional question on this subject. K2LYW, go ahead, Joe.
Okay, taking for instance is an installation like what you have. I don't know if you have one beam. But say you have two beams and you co-phase them. Instead of one beam, you're running two beams. And here's the question. It's actually maybe a two-part question, two parts of it. If you had one beam set up slanted 45 left, the other antenna is fed in phase, co-phase, fed in phase with a co-phasing harness, and that antenna is on the other side of your vertical mast, but they're both horizontal from each other, and that's slanted 45 right. I think you'd get a gain, but you still have a 3 dB difference between vertical and to horizontal, correct? Now, would that pattern or anything change if instead of the antennas being horizontal from each other, they were stacked vertically from each other? But again, one slanted vertical, one slanted 45 right, one slanted 45 left. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, when you study vector mathematics, a vector is something that has a direction and a magnitude, and it's usually represented like an arrow. You can draw an arrow on your page, and if the arrow is slanted, is going from left to right, you and I would call it a horizontally polarized vector. And if the arrow goes up and down on the page, you and I would call it a vertically polarized vector. So the horizontally polarized, the antenna that's slanted 45 right is making a vector slanted 45 right and slanted 45 left with the other one. When you combine the two vectors, slanted right and slanted left becomes horizontally polarized. And you're next going to ask the question, is there a vertical component left over? And I think the answer is yes. If the two antennas, the two Yagis in your example, are horizontally displaced from each other, you've now got a horizontally displaced interferometer antenna. When you do that, if they were both parallel to the ground as far as polarization is concerned, let me drop. And in my particular case, I've really studied this very well when it comes to the 19-element RIW Yagi. A 19-element RIW Yagi, one single Yagi with 19 elements all by itself, has something like a 26 degree beam width. When you put a pair of them side by side, the main lobe now becomes 5.5 degrees beam width for the main lobe. But the first side lobe, which is something like 12 degrees away from the main lobe, the first side lobe is also something like 5.5 degrees wide, and it's inside of the envelope of each individual Yagi, 26 degrees. So you're getting a funny interferometry pattern when you put two antennas side by side. Or if you just vertically stack them, your vertical beamwidth develops interferometry lobes like that. But now when you slant them 45 degrees like this, and now you simultaneously look off to one angle, polarization gets complicated. Without a doubt, it's going to be an elliptical polarization, because one antenna is, if they're horizontally displaced and my signal is aimed dead north, but my target I'm listening to is that at a 10 degree azimuth angle. Let me drop. So the guy I want to talk to is north-northeast. He's a little bit off of north, but the antenna is aimed to the north. And I've got two Yagis horizontally displaced from each other, 5.5 feet would be the right stacking distance for a 19-element Yagi with a 13-foot long boom. 5.5 feet is the correct stacking distance. And one is slanted 45 right, and one is slanted 45 left. And I've now, because the guy I'm listening to, he is off to the north-northeast. He sees the signal from the right-hand Yagi sooner than the left-hand Yagi, because he's closer to that one. That's the geometry of what's going on. Therefore, he sees a signal out of that Yagi ahead in phase. So a signal ahead in phase, slanted 45 right, compared to a signal on the other Yagi, delayed in phase, 45 left, when I put that all together, he sees elliptical polarization. I know that's not an easy one to swallow, but can you see a little bit of what's going on there, Joe? The B2LYY, B2LIW in the TechNet. We're about to go over to an announcement right away. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, yeah, you can break off your announcement. I'm trying to understand this, but it becomes a little complicated. I've got to have the announcement.
Yeah, let's make sure we finish with Sam now. Sam, KC1SAM, you're in a fairly complicated area. The first time you hear all this jazz, not easy to swallow. However, polarimetry is a very important parameter. If you and I were running the world's best radio telescope, and we're looking at some particular star, and if this is the world's best radio telescope antenna, it would have polarimetry measurement capability. When I look at that star, I would like to know how much horizontal energy, how much vertical energy, how much slant 45 energy, how much clockwise circular polarized energy, and counterclockwise circular polarized energy that star is emitting at each individual frequency that I care to look at that star. That's called polarimetry measurements. When you make those kind of polarimetry measurements and you properly interpret them, it gives you, by way of the Zeeman effect, it gives you the ability to know what was the local magnetic field like near that star. Ain't that crazy? KC1, SAM for any final on this one. K2LIW, you got it, Sam.
K2RIW, KC1AM picking it up. No, I appreciate it very, very much. Your question, as far as when you were far beyond that, actually. But my question was, obviously, what happens in the direction that the dipole would be leaning. I was curious about that. I appreciate it very, very much. As far as the rest of it goes, it's far more than extremely interesting. It's very, very interesting. It was not my life work, but something I always said is very interesting. Anyway, I'm going to pass it back to what's going on in the net, and I'm one of those guys who you sit back and let me break for a second. I'm one of those guys you say that you sure is listening, and I have been listening for several weeks, and I will be. I sit back, and if I come up with a question, I will toss it out to you. But I appreciate your time and input. This is KC1 Sierra Alpha Mike. Going to stand by. I'm going to pass it back to you there. It's at KC2RIW. And thank you very much for your comments.
Comment.
Okay, we're going to go over to the announcement. And after the announcement, I'll pick up your comment, Wes. As you guys know, one of our favorite people that we're really going to miss is John, KC2WGB, who is doing a yeoman job of maintaining the mailbag, among other things, with the TechNet. And he became a silent key recently, and we got officially informed about it something like Monday afternoon. And that was announced on the technical report of Limark last Monday night. So we are planning an event, and the person who quite possibly is going to be heading up that event is going to be Roy, AC2GS. So I hope Roy is on frequency, and he's going to tell us about an event which I believe it was Roy's idea, the event that we're about to hear about, that he's going to be planning, by which we can give a memorial to John. Alpha Charlie 2, Golf Sierra, if you're there, Roy, please proceed. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, this is AC2GS right here. Yeah, I was chatting with Handy Andy N2HUH, and he mentioned something that I had in the back of my mind, that it would be really nice if we could sort of reenact what John did many nights on the repeater. He would kind of come to the front of the mic and sit down and around 9:30 and call out his call sign and get involved in conversations that would go on and on, sometimes until the dawn. So I thought it would be kind of nice if we arranged something like that, a bit of an Irish wake, if you will. I'm not Irish, neither was John, but I think it's a suitable memorial for him. So I was thinking Friday at 9:30 p.m. I talked to Rich, K2KNB, and he's going to leave the repeater stay on through the night if we can chat through the night. And I thought that it would be a great opportunity to kind of celebrate a well-engineered and a well-designed life that John had.
By the way, if you guys go to QRZ.com and you type in Kilo Charlie 2 WGB Whiskey Golf Bravo, you go to his website and you look at the photograph of the ham radio equipment and test equipment that's in his two separate side-by-side laboratories that are in his garage. My goodness, was he a well-equipped guy. He's one of those guys that was very lucky with the company he worked at. They abandoned certain pieces of equipment and said, John, why don't you take them? And so he fell in soft. That's where some of it came from. An awful lot of it he had to buy, an awful lot of it he went to flea markets. But quite a character. And there are people who have had conversations with him until the wee hours of the morning. So from what I hear, a certain fraction of my family, let me drop this. A certain fraction of my family is Irish. I've got ancestry that goes back to County Cork and County Mayo. And so, from what I hear, that when a truly Irish person dies and they hold a wake, at least a certain portion of the Irish people say that this is not a sad event, this is a happy event. This man has gone on to a better hereafter. He has made it, so to speak. And so we should celebrate with happiness as opposed to sadness. That's their attitude. I think that's somewhat what goes on with an Irish wake. So I think you're saying, Roy, you're going to start at 9 o'clock at night. You're going to gather as many people as you can. We're going to tell our war stories about John. I met John at the so-and-so flea market, and we did such-and-such. I talked to him 2 o'clock in the morning on this particular subject, and this is what we settled on, and so on. So I think you're going to gather people with that kind of a celebration, if I've got it correct. Is that true, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, that's the plan. The plan is not to be maudlin. This is not a funeral. This, to me, is a celebration. And so old war stories, conversations, he has had thousands and thousands and thousands. He has spoken with the brightest, not quite the brightest, and not quite the sanest. But, you know, I would hope and appreciate if all of them would come on down and tell their stories into the wee hours of the night.
Thank you, Will.
Okay, so I think this is being planned for this particular Friday night. Now, let's see, this is a 13th, 14th, 15th, 18th, August 18th. K2YO, Bernie, you want to fill on that? You've got a Bernie, K2YOW.
Just about to add to it, first thing, you are spot on. Last year I married a buddy of mine who's an Irishman, and the wake was a wonderfully happy thing. Well, I should say we drank a lot of different things at the time. This would be a slightly, shall we say, more saner than on Friday, but I left with you here, Roy, but it'll be a little bit later. I'll probably roll around by 10, 11 at night, maybe 12. But I will be there. My suggestion, and Roy, I'm throwing it to you just because I don't know who to bring this to. How do we get in touch with Dick's family so that they could, or maybe we could get them a radio they can tune in so they could listen?
You mean John's family?
QSL, I'm sorry, it's getting late. I've been working down the shop here, so I'm hot and sweaty, discombobulated.
Understood. Well, I know Wesley has spoken with his daughter, Donna. Maybe he can arrange for something. That would be nice to have. And I'm sure John has a more than enough radios to be able to do it rather easily with.
We've got Wes on frequency, Jeff. Yeah. Wes, I think you have had contact recently with Donna. I think she's got a ham radio license, but there I'm not sure. You've been to her house on a number of occasions, so you would know. And so, do you think Donna would appreciate actually listening to the memorial, so to speak? N2XJM, K2RIW, you got it, Wes.
Yeah, N2XJM. Yeah, I spoke to her a few times, I was authorized to give the information exactly the same time when Rich got the information as well. I had to call her again. I didn't contact her in this particular project or this particular event. So I do have to call her and ask her. Maybe it would be also possible that I would be able to come over and switch the radio and have it there, so she would be able to listen. There is additional problem here. Let me jump. She's not well, as well. I mean, she's not well. So, although we want to have a beautiful event, and that would be a happy event, we gotta also think about how she feels about that being to participate in it. I really cannot say too much.
Now, what I think Wes is referring to is the fact that Donna, his daughter, is about to undergo a fairly significant medical procedure. AG2I, here we go. AG2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Well, there's a whole bunch of different ways that we can handle it, if you ask me. She doesn't even need a radio. I can stream it on the internet. If she has something that has a web browser, a cell phone, a iPad, a computer, she can listen to the stream. Or I can record it and archive it, and I'll give a copy to Wesley. He could give a copy to her. She could listen to it if she wants to, when she wants to.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Take it up.
Yeah, one of the things you guys don't know about is that that beautiful website called amateurradio.tangovictor.